they sent him back a thing like, fill out these questions, and I was helping him out with it.
Oh, yeah.
So totally, like, if he gets hired, it's all because of me.
Yeah, take all that credit.
Yeah, for sure, for sure.
Yeah, I saw him the other day over at the help desk.
Yeah, yeah.
I was in a really, really bad mood because I was at getting stuff printed. So you're always in a bad mood.
Jesus, you're always in a bad mood.
And didn't say hi to him, but then luckily I ran into him the other night at the White Horse. Mm. We had a little chat.
So, a little chit-chat, yeah.
Yeah. So how have you been?
I'm good, you know. Pretty standard week of playing video games and getting some work done.
Yeah,
responding nice. To some feedback, you know. Mm. We got a little bit of feedback, Tom.
Yeah, we did.
I think you got a little bit of feedback, really.
Yeah, I mean, I think the issue is that, you know, in any setting such as this, and those that participate in things like podcasts and online feedback are going to fall on your side of that argument.
Oh, wait. What are you saying?
What am I saying?
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying.
You're saying that people who use the internet would fall on the side of me? My side of the argument? Yeah, okay. People
not use the internet. People that are more actively involved in the internet. To the point that they're people that use the internet enough to discover our podcast.
All right. Well, okay, let's just breeze through them because they're not maybe all that important.
Yeah.
The first thing was that actually I got some feedback before I even released the episode because I sent it to my brother who's on the Dwell On podcast.
Great podcast, by the way.
They talk about houses and stuff, and he responded most heavily to your comment about toaster ovens.
Yeah.
And he was listening to it and sending me messages. So it's like, he sent me this like, what? And then he was like, oh, okay, he reined it in. If you missed last episode, Tom said that he thought toaster ovens were he found them more in lower income houses or poor people's houses. And then pretty quickly after that, you kind of followed it up. I, at the time, kind of disagreed with you, but I understood what you meant, which is like, if a person doesn't have any... Well, no. What I think you meant was if someone only has a toaster oven, it's probably like a crappy college house or like just kind of like small, simple living. Generally, people with money have an oven, and then if they have both an oven and a toaster oven, what I was saying was that to me is a symbol of more wealth.
Yeah, I guess I thought about it more after we talked about it. Mm-hmm. And the thing for me is that most of the toaster ovens I see, again, are old
and like dirty and kind of broken,
and I realize it's like, okay, so most kids in my demographic, middle income college students, of their kitchen is put together.
And by middle income college students, like when we say poor people, that's what we mean, like college students.
But I'm saying like our, you know, we, our parents have a fair amount, you know, have income, and so our houses are furnished with like old, like 1980s toaster ovens from our grandma. Like, I don't think I have seen a toaster oven newer than like 1991.
Okay, so they are.
So that's why
I
associate it with that. I think that's why I associate it with like being poor.
Yeah, totally. I mean, if you can afford to have counter space to put a toaster oven on it, like then you're doing well because you got to have more counter space, right, for more stuff.
Yeah, which I do not have enough
as a plug. As a plug for Dwell On, that's the episode I'm most excited for, I think, is when they talk about kitchens and like what to put where in a kitchen.
Ooh.
and like devices and appliances and stuff. I thought about this a lot because my mom really likes to cook, and we moved when I was in high school, and like my parents built the house, and we always joked that the reason we moved was because my mom didn't have enough counter space between the oven and the sink in the kitchen. And like, honestly, that might be kind of true. Like, we joke about it, but it might be a little bit true.
After seeing how she designed the kitchen currently uses, it seems to make a lot of sense.
Because there's a lot of space between the oven and the sink. But anyway, like, she's very, I don't know if frugal is the right word, but she's very frugal about what she keeps on her counter. So she has like a nice mixer, and then there's a microwave in one spot, and she doesn't even leave they don't use a toaster oven, they use a pop-up toaster. She doesn't even leave that on the counter. She like puts that in a cupboard out of the way so that she has more counter space. The coffee pot too, and like some, you know, stereo and some stuff. But so part of it is like they take up some room, and they always seem to me like people that had the space, you know.
Probably.
You know. Yeah. Also, yeah. They're awesome. If you're cooking small things, if you eat frozen foods at all, or heat little things up, toaster ovens are fantastic.
See, okay, when you use an example like that,
I know, I think exactly. So what
I was not thinking, a sign of wealth. I eat a lot of small portioned frozen food items.
I was watching Trailer Park Boys the other night, kind of reliving fantastic. The early episodes because I haven't watched those in a long time. And yeah, so there's a character who doesn't live in a trailer. He lives in a car. And there's a scene where he's cooking with a toaster oven and has an electrical cord like stretched out of the neighboring trailer. And then that guy gets mad because it's actually his toaster oven. He comes out and takes it back and like dumps the guy's chicken fingers on the ground.
That show is just so good.
It's very dark, very dark. Trailer Park Boys is great. Okay, so the other feedback we got we got some pieces of several things about toasters. We got some feedback about our argument about Instagram. I don't think we want to get too deep into it, but the general consensus was that, and I'm going to go ahead and apologize for you, or maybe I just misunderstood. I don't think that you were saying people who get inspiration from Instagram are terrible artists. At least I don't think you believe that. Maybe you were saying explicitly that.
No. I was saying that Instagram, just to clarify in case someone missed last week, that Instagram, I believe, is a poor way to be introduced to photography.
I think, like, it's maybe not the, I mean, I'm not going to say it's the best or the worst or it's a good or bad way. There are probably better ways to be introduced to photography, like having a fantastic photographer mentor give you his old camera and, like, take you on a walk. And, like, that would be, like, the most amazing way, right?
Yeah.
And, like, being the child of a war photographer that, like, did, like, documenting war, would be a really fantastic way to learn about photography, because generally people that are in like high stress photography situations have really interesting views on how to, you know, shoot photos.
Yeah. Would you think that being introduced to guitar how would you feel about garage? What's that?
I'm assuming you're going
rock
to go
band.
Rock band or guitar rock band. Hero. If that causes someone to learn to play guitar, that's awesome. And in fact, I have this response is from
is it though?
Okay,
is it a good way to be introduced?
Well, if it causes you to play guitar, then great. Like, if you wouldn't have learned to play guitar without the video game, then it's kind of cool that you got to it, and like good for the video game for kind of pushing you in that direction. I remember we got an email from my cousin Andy, who hosts another show on Dwell On. You can see there another show on Verb Mill. You can see our co-hosts really like to respond. And this isn't the only response, but he did the best writing about the Instagram argument. My other cousin, Aaron, plays a lot of guitar and he plays in a band. And I remember I was hanging out with him once and we were playing Guitar Hero, or maybe Rock Band. I don't know the difference. I'm really bad at it. And like I was not doing as well as him, but kind of keeping up. And I made a little bit of fun of him, like, because he's like, he's this fantastic guitarist and I obviously don't play very well. And he said, yeah, I used to be really good, but then I realized that I also liked playing real guitar, and it was like I could spend half an hour practicing a song in this or half an hour practicing a song on the real guitar, and like that was a kind of a no-brainer. So he didn't come to guitar after playing the game, but he you know, had the experience of kind of progressing and becoming a better guitarist as well as, you know, becoming better at the video game. So I think that's like The big takeaway for me was that, and, you know, he used some strong language here about not necessarily
he gave a nice criticism.
He says the problem with your continued argument, however, is that you said that art is not easy. You are absolutely right. However, the bar you have to jump over to get into art is very easy, and I don't think you disagree with that.
I do.
You think that it's really. You think it's very difficult to get into art?
Okay, I think that it's very difficult to get into art in a legitimate way.
Oh, and I say that like because such a, wait, no, that's no, such wait, a wait, shitty way to look at it. I know what you're going to say. Go ahead.
Because I sit there and I am someone who goes to school with a bunch of people, and it's very easy to take something that you're good at and keep doing it, which is often what art is. But to make something that you're good at, take something you're good at and then make good work and really jump into like what art making is very difficult.
Okay. Okay.
And it's not easy. And it's easy for me because it's something I enjoy doing. And in that sense, it's easy.
Yeah, it's easy but for there you are because, many, many, because you many, enjoy the challenge and like it's, yeah, it's not
but
like
the challenge
work,
is
like,
definitely there
that you hate doing. I think that is a common sort of view of what art school is for. And it's not necessarily to teach you technique, but it's like to teach you how to be an artist and how to like form ideas and critique art and like get better at your craft and like constantly be improving and thinking about it and whatnot. But he goes on to say, I would not have gone to art school and pursued a career as a graphic designer, except that art was fun for me in grade school, middle school, and high school. It didn't cost me a dime, and it was easy. And I think that's exactly right. And so, like, barrier to start making art or, like, getting interested in art or doing things is kind of low. And then the point of art school or, you know, kind of becoming a professional artist, one of the things you have to do is start to take on the challenge of refining it.
Yeah.
And
I just think that we're lowering the bar with Instagram.
That's just
and we
wrong.
Hit the
God, you're
Yeah, I'm just saying that it is. And I'm wondering how low are you going to take
it? And you know, they said the same thing about impressionism and that they're lowering the bar of painting because that doesn't look like anything.
When you know, Cézanne and Monet were painting, they weren't doing it. They weren't introduced to art through impressionism.
I mean, that's
they weren't introduced
also
to
true.
Painting, and so they learned something, and then they critically decided to make the decision to paint differently.
Yeah, and
whereas like when currently when you learn like there's a large emphasis on modernist painting right now, we're not still doing that, but there's an emphasis on learning and building on what came before you, and there's an emphasis on understanding the process of art making before you decide to change. The process of art making.
So then it sounds like you're just jealous that people who are learning to shoot photos with an iPhone or an Android phone and Instagram are learning in a much easier way because
no.
they're starting after you. I get what you're saying. I get what you're saying. And that's But
I'm just saying you can't change it until you really understand it. I don't think. And there's a learning curve that no one's being forced to go up with Instagram.
Okay, so there's another kind of step back thought process that I have, or just kind of a general theory I have about the advent of new technology and old mediums. And I did an internship with a letterpress printmaker, who I think we could actually plug on the show. It's Mary Bruno. And since it's holiday time, she's a printmaker in St. Joe, Minnesota, and she sells some fantastic letterpressed cards that are pretty offensive. So we'll link to her in the show notes. You should check her work out. But while I was interning there, there were some fellow interns who did book arts. And so they did, you know, like making handmade paper and then like binding it into books and like using that as an art form, as well as just generally being interested in publishing books. And we got into this discussion about my clear and obvious understanding that books will soon not be printed on paper. And that the form of written word is moving away from paper because there's no real reason to keep it on paper. And all of the advantages of electronic books are quickly increasing. And all of the disadvantages of paper books are becoming more obvious. Anyway, they were kind of upset with me because they thought that ruined their craft as artists or it cheapened their craft as artists. And I think that was actually backwards because if electronic books take off in this way that we just expect them to, it will mean that the decision to make a physical book has different and more weight and will then be kind of a bigger decision and will cause the art to have more meaning or maybe
the other
different
thing
meaning.
Too. Well, okay, we were discussing this in one of my classes. I have a professor who works pretty much primarily in making and publishing books.
Mm-hmm.
He makes artist books and works with other artists to do them and does some of his own. And in the last 10 years, book arts has flourished more than any other time ever.
Right.
And he said that it happens, there's like a twofold reason for it happening. A, like you said, it's a bold decision to make a book now. It becomes, and there can be a level of craft to it. But the other thing is, it's super easy to make books nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
It is so easy to have a book printed.
Yeah, and you can self-publish for like less than $100. You can start selling a book on Amazon, like a paperback or a hardcover book.
Like they did, they're doing, at the school I attend, they're doing like a publication book now at the end of every semester of the seniors graduating. So that the seniors can say, hey, I've been published.
Yeah, I've been published. My pa.
Because it's $100. Like, it's not hard.
Yeah, and so we got into talking about it some more. And Mary Bruno is this fantastic letterpress printmaker. We were talking about it. Letterpress is the kind of old school printing technique where you actually have metal letters that emboss a page and add ink. And we were talking about how in the past, when it was like the best or the newest technology for printing, what was considered high quality printmaking was not embossing the page at all, but still getting ink on it. So you wouldn't get any indent from the letters on the page. And you can manipulate that by having different types of paper and different amounts of pressure. And if you're good, you can control that completely. And she was saying, you know, that used to be the way that this works. And now what's popular is seeing the indent on the page. Because what it does is it shows that you're using this old method and it's something you can't get from any other medium. That's simply because the technology was replaced by a newer and, for most purposes, better way of doing it. Then I got to thinking about this quote that may or may not actually be from Jay Leno, but I remember Jay Leno talking about it on the British car show Top Gear. And he talked about his love of cars and he talked about Henry Ford and how Henry Ford, you know, modernized the assembly line to make the production of cars feasible and cheap, and then the car or the automobile killed the horse because the horse stopped being something that people would use for work, at least in mass, because you could use a car instead, and it was better in almost every way. And his main point coming away from that was that actually saved the horse. Because it meant that people who kept horses kept them. I mean, obviously they're still used for a lot of work, and it was a long process. Yeah. But they were used as then pleasurable things, and they were kept for like these possessions or these pets that people had. I don't really know how you want to look at it, but that they became these things that people used for the quality of the horse, like the joy of riding, or like the, you know,
relationship with the animal.
Yeah, exactly.
However,
as far as I know, horses are pretty dumb, so I don't know if you can actually have a relationship with them. But it's that same sort of thing, that the newer form of doing it killed off the older way of doing it, and that was better. In a lot of ways, digital photography has kind of destroyed the real, like the in mass use of film, but it has meant that there's more weight and meaning when you shoot film for art.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways, Instagram might be killing off some parts, and this is not totally what your argument was, but this is gets to Andy's point about how you were saying Instagram might be cheapening photography. And it might be cheapening photography in some way, but it's also empowering people who use photos as an art form rather than as a document, a form of documenting their life. And I couldn't conjugate that word properly. As a way of documenting their life. I think that means that Instagram is probably empowering people who use photography consciously. And I don't think it's a stretch to think that a lot of the people who are coming from Instagram will learn that there are other ways of using photography other than just documenting what they're doing, which is really, I think, a fair criticism is like, or just a fair distinction that like there are photos that are meant to document something, and that's what you see in the newspaper. And then there are photos that are meant to kind of communicate something and kind of be art or be a thing. And Instagram is kind of this weird middle ground, but it's definitely more document what's happening. Or at least most people that I'm familiar with use it as document what's happening.
Yeah. The difference is that they document this.
Well, they're documenting things that we find boring. Let's not beat around the bush. Like, I don't care what you're eating for lunch that much. I mean, maybe I care what you're eating for lunch because we're friends, but probably not really.
But not even. Unless it's like something. And I love the idea of like using my phone, taking a picture of something funny, and sending it to one person.
Well, that's,
there's a thought.
But
like today. Like today, I sent you a picture because I knew Will is going to find this funny. And there's intimacy and there's a thought process in why I took that photo and who I took that photo for.
You could do the same thing if you had, you know, 5 followers on Instagram. If you had like 5 of your close friends were following you, you would post things that you thought they would find funny. And then if you had 30 people, you would still kind of be posting things that you wanted that audience to see.
Yeah. I think it's rare.
And if you had 30,000, it would still be essentially like these people will find this funny or clever or smart or interesting.
It It would not be a thought. It's very hard to have the same level of thoughtfulness when you're doing Instagram.
It might be more thoughtful if you have a huge audience, because then you have to appeal to more people or have a more specific voice.
Yes, because that's what art is.
Well, I mean, again, this might not be high art. We're not putting dick quotes around art.
I am.
And that's like, you know, paintings of barns and pheasants that we both don't enjoy, but that doesn't really
mean
it's bad.
And so I'm saying, if you get introduced to painting by looking at Terry Redlin rather than looking at Mark Rothko, Terry Redlin is a bad way, in my mind,
to
be introduced
to art. The barrier of entry is so much lower, though. Like, to get into Rothko, and not, I mean, I don't want to be a dick and say, like, if you don't know anything about painting and you like Rothko, you like it for the wrong reasons. That's not what I'm saying. But it takes a lot more to understand or like or appreciate Rothko than it does to understand or appreciate, you know, realistic still life photography. Photography, painting. And it's a systemic and terrible problem that kind of gets beat into people in art school, I think. That, like, they learn to hate the kind of lower forms or that's the way of looking at it. That, like, that Terry Redlin is a lower form of painting, or that, like, realistic painting is a lower form because it's easier. And it's easier to understand. It may not be easier to do, but it's easier to understand. It's easier to view and appreciate. And I think we both really appreciate art that's not easy to understand. And I kind of, I really find myself drawn to art that other people don't like. I think that says a lot about my personality. But
well, yeah, definitely.
But generally speaking, like,
what would you say is your favorite work of art?
I'm not ready to answer that question. You threw that on me. But maybe you should
answer
it and I'll think
one.
About it.
It was a big.
Oh no, I already have an answer. But go ahead. You can share yours.
Yeah, no, I mean...
It's difficult. It's really unfair.
I would have to say any of Frank Stella's black paintings.
Okay.
Any of them. Dai Fu Ho is kind of a front runner right now just because I'm writing a paper on it, so it's on the top of my mind.
So you're thinking... Yeah.
But any of those black paintings.
And like, my favorite piece of art is John Cage's 433. Right, and like, generally everyone hates that, at least... Everyone that I'm around hates that, and certainly the barrier of entry is very high. And if you don't know anything about it, you think like that's the type of music that I'm going to write because it's really easy to write that type of music. If you're not familiar, 433 is a piece to be performed by an orchestra of any size or an individual musician. And it is three movements totaling 4 minutes and 33 seconds, and the instructions are to not play any notes at all. So essentially, it's 4 minutes and 33 seconds of silence. But it's wonderful and fantastic, and you know, we don't really need to get into my description of my love for it. But, you know, like, that would not be possible without Cage spending his whole life kind of learning and thinking about music and how music is made and what is and is not music.
And performing and being in performance.
And just generally being surrounded by postmodernists or the progression towards postmodernism or postmodernist theory. But, like, had he learned to play by some crappy, fake sort of piano, or, like, had his first exposure to music been this really terrible Instagram form of music in the early 1900s or maybe late 1800s. I don't really know. I think early 1900s. Yeah. He might have died kind of recently. I should probably figure that out. That wouldn't make his good work any worse. And I think...
No, but it would have made him... I think it would have been a lot harder for him to get to the level he got to.
I don't know if that's necessarily true. I think that's a fundamental disagreement we have. Finally, one more example of this, which... I'm bringing up because I think I fell on your side of this argument, was about video games. And, like, I care a lot about video games and I play a lot of video games. I was thinking about this a lot because Andy talked about his interest in art really coming from being in art in school. And I think my interest in design and interfaces really came from playing Halo, because a lot of the decisions that the makers of that game made were things that I thought about, and I thought about, like, well, why is this decision this way, and why does it work this way? And then I thought about interfaces, and I thought about design and systems and structure and so on. But for a long time, I really kept up with video game news. And before the Nintendo Wii came out, I remember I had a lot of arguments online and with my friends about it. And my thought was, like, this is cheap. It's crappy. The video games are going to be terrible because the system was really weak. The controls were silly. There's nothing good about it, blah, blah, blah. To an extent, that's true. To an extent, the games on it are very shallow. There are not as deep, complex games on the Wii as there are on other consoles or on the computer. But I came to start thinking, like, this is better, or better than I thought it was, because it's exposing more people to video games. And hopefully they will start to realize there are other great games, and the kind of the genre for art or as a pastime, it will gain more acceptance because people will have more experience with it. And people who previously had said, like, I don't play any video games, now say, like, I don't play any video games except the Wii. And they're starting to see, like, oh, I do play some video games. Like, it's a thing. It's like kind of like watching movies or watching TV. It's just a thing that people
do. I'm curious to know how many people jump from being a Wii user. I mean, I understand as like a child. As like a child, you would play the Wii because it's very childish. But people who are like my age, who haven't been really into video games, if I were to start with the Wii, would I move to an Xbox or a PlayStation?
You probably wouldn't start playing video games with a Wii and move that much. Or at least maybe you would, but like my parents' neighbors bought a Wii and they occasionally play bowling. Like, they probably never bought any games for it. They probably just play the ones that came with it, and they probably do that very rarely. But it still increased the overall like acceptance of video games and culture, and like really provided kind of this platform for more people to know about video games. It also maybe hurt in some ways because if everyone just plays Wii Bowling or Angry Birds, they're going to think of video games as being like these very simple pastimes and pleasurable things rather than these complex stories that can be delivered through this interesting medium. So like someone who plays Angry Birds maybe has no understanding of how Skyrim, this like 100-hour plus game with this fantastic story and hundreds of characters, works. So that's an interesting thought, and I think it's a little bit different and more nuanced maybe than our argument about Instagram, but it's something I've been thinking about for a really long time.
I heard of this, I heard of a Christmas party, not somebody I know, it was like a friend of a friend was telling me that she got invited to this Christmas party, she was not able to attend, she was really sad, and I was like, yeah, but Christmas parties all kind of suck, they have to do with ugly Christmas sweaters, they probably have a pretty like generic eggnog there, and it's probably pretty, you know. And she's like, no, this sounded like a fantastic party. And I was like, why? She said that the theme of the party was Santa Claus, so everyone had to come dressed as Santa Claus.
All right, that's kind of funny.
And you could come as like a different form of Santa Claus, and apparently these girls throw it every year, and it's a majority of like a female party, so they come with just these like fantastic like female transgender Santa Clauses that are like Hawaiian Santa or
see we, one go ahead
yeah I guess that the one girl that was going this year was going with her friend as the Men in Black Santas.
See, this is actually really clever. I was expecting this very early to turn into a college everyone goes as slutty Santa party. Which is just like wear red underwear basically.
Show up in red underwear, you are okay.
Ugly sweater parties, I'm not really on board with. I think they're kind of boring.
Yeah.
Because, like,
I've been invited to plenty, and I just don't ever go.
Like, what's the... There's no threshold for a sweater is actually ugly without intentionally being ugly.
Yeah.
Like if it's really going to be the ugliest sweater at the ugly sweater party, it's clear that it was intentionally made ugly. My dad went to one once, or we all went, and I think it was my dad's idea. We like covered him in like tinsel and like hung ugly Christmas ornaments from his sweater. That was kind of
so
fun.
So he like made the sweater ugly for the party. That's good.
It's cheating though. It's cheating.
It is. It is. Yeah. I got a good Christmas shirt I bought online the other day.
Yeah.
I think I talked about this. We talked about Christmas Story, didn't I?
Yes, we did. Yes, we did.
We did. Never mind. Gosh, we're repeating ourselves, Will.
Yep.
Been around here too long.
So hood up.
Anyway, moving on.
Let's move on. We have a Christmas commercial to show.
Yeah, fantastic one at that.
That's a spoiler, isn't it? Let's go ahead. Let's go ahead and play it right now for everybody.
Good times for a change. See the luck I've had. Could make a good man turn bad.
Do we have to describe what's happening? I mean, I suppose we have to describe because we're assuming everybody listening hasn't seen this. But
although we did tell them.
We did tell you to, but still, if you haven't seen this ad, it's one of those, like, almost entirely music and images ad. Like, there's, you're not really going to gain anything from listening to it right now. So you should pause the podcast and go to verbmill.net/thewhitehorsecourier/14 and grab the link to this ad. So you see it before we talk about it, because there is a punchline and you don't want it ruined. Except I already just ruined it by saying there was a punchline.
Yeah. Well, it's pretty obvious that something is building throughout the ad.
Yes, it's true. It's obviously that, you know. But if you're too lazy to pause the podcast and go watch it right now, this is a advertisement for John Lewis, which is a department store in our fair neighbor, the British Isles.
British Isles?
I have no idea where they are. Obviously, they're in England and probably the rest of those islands, but also maybe the rest of Europe. I just have no idea. And I looked it up, but it was really hard to tell where they had locations. The entire ad, it starts with a young kid waking up and opening up the first box of an advent calendar. I never had an advent calendar as a kid, but I still knew what they were. It's just like every day in December leading up to Christmas. Is it every day in December, or is it just like,
I think so.
Yeah, so it's, so you've got 24 boxes and you open them up and generally it's like there's a chocolate inside each box. It doesn't, that's not, there are not, there are more than 24 days in Advent though.
I don't know. Whatever.
Advent has 28 days. So, or 27 days, I guess, maybe, I don't know. Advent is 4 weeks. Anyway.
Anyway.
Doesn't matter.
So you have this calendar.
Just doesn't matter.
Building up to Christmas. Yep. So this kid opens
You open up a piece of chocolate, and then the rest of it is just like this kid obviously waiting for Christmas. There's a scene where he's sitting on the floor in the kitchen and he's bouncing a ball against the wall like you often see prisoners doing in movies. There's a scene where he's on a couch next to his dad and his dad is reading the newspaper and he's just staring straight at the camera and bouncing his leg up and down really fast. So it's building and building, and you see him kind of looking off into the distance and looking morose and like trying to wait until Christmas. And then you can tell because he opens up the 24th box and closes it, and then you see him go to bed. So you know the next scene is going to be him waking up on Christmas, and he pops out of bed, and there's this big pile of presents by the foot of his bed, and he runs past them into his closet, and he grabs this really terribly wrapped present, and he carries it to his parents' room, and they kind of wake up as he comes in. And he's just grinning and holding these presents. And then it says, for the presents you just can't wait to give. And then, you know, John Lewis department store.
Yeah.
We sell t-shirts.
And we sell t-shirts.
Phew, boy. Just a fantastic commercial.
It is. It's shot super well.
Yep.
The kid is one of the better child actors I've seen in a very long time.
Oh, he's totally believable. He looks like an old man in most of it, like an old man waiting.
Yeah, he just seems pissed. Like, when is my Christmas going to come?
It's like pissed and determined at the same time.
Yeah.
I am very anxious. Very good. Oh, man.
And then, and I think they did a really good job of, like, you know, not even necessarily getting that, like, the anticipation of Christmas, because there's like, he's like more intense than that.
Yeah, it's way too.
But they did a really good job of, like, you know, when you're a kid and like you're waiting for someone to pick you up, like to go to like the school carnival or something, your friend's mom is going to pick you up. That's how you wait for things. Like there's this scene where his like sibling is like watercoloring at the table and he's like not participating at all. He's just sitting there like bouncing his hand on the table like, I want something to happen that isn't this.
Yeah.
Which I thought was really nice.
Aesthetically, the commercial is also beautiful. It's got a nice warming filter, so everything looks really warm, even though there's lots of snow and Christmas time stuff. It's got this kind of very loose melodic music in the background that is not too cheerful, but also not too sad. Like, if you watch this commercial without the music, it's pretty creepy. Like, it's kind of like it's way more disturbing. If it had been upbeat, happy music, it wouldn't have really fit. It's like, they did a really good job of actually commissioning that piece, I believe. It's a cover, and I think they commissioned it for the commercial. This was done by the advertising agency Adam and Eve DDB, which is a full-service ad agency in London. And it gets away with a lot of things that other commercials can't do, in that it has a very slow building narrative because it's a minute and a half long.
Yeah.
And that's something I don't think we should forget, because it's, you know, if you've got a minute and a half of time to play with, you've got plenty of time to build a good story. 30 seconds.
Versus the normal 30 seconds.
Yeah, 30 seconds is enough time to build a good story, especially enough time to build a funny story. Which is why 30-second commercials are often, you know, have a punchline that's a joke rather than have a sad punchline. Not that this is explicitly sad.
Or in this case, a sweet.
Yeah, a sweet kind of a tearjerker. It's hard to get that in 30 seconds, but in a minute and a half, you got enough time. I've got this piece that Harry Wallop wrote for the Daily Telegraph, but I found it on Business Insider, which is just this terrible website. Terrible, terrible news
site. Yeah, why were you on Business
Insider? No, I was looking up stuff about this commercial, and I found it on Business Insider.
The way you said that, I knew that's how you came across, but the way you said it, I was worried our listeners were going to think you were like perusing Business Outsider.
No, Business Outsider. Business Insider. Another problem with this goddamn site, this terrible site. When you copy and paste something from the site, they've got JavaScript running to throw in some extra crap. So that you paste it, and it's like, read more on Business Insider, and then there's a link to your article. And it's like, I can see why they do it, but it's still the wrong decision, and it's really anti-user. Really, really frustrating. Anyway, they have a bit of an interview with Craig Inglis. This is actually about this ad that we're talking about right now came out in 2011, and he's talking about the 2012 ad. And the 2012 ad is, I don't think, as good or interesting, but still worth watching. We'll obviously link to it in our show notes as well. But he talks about the 2012 ad, which features, instead of people, it's about snowmen. And he says, when you watch it again and again, you grow to love the snowman, and you start to look at him as a human. And you look at him the same way you did the kid last year. The snowman becomes a metaphor for that child. And there's a lot of stuff in this, really. One thing is that they felt so strongly that last year's commercial was so good that they wanted to have a metaphor for the character in last year's commercial in this year's commercial. And that's pretty awesome for like these high budget.
It's pretty impressive.
Right? Like, these are £6 billion or $10 million commercials. Like, they're putting a lot into these. So that's really impressive. But also, it's interesting because it's about like making a snowman into a character, like a kid, and making a snowman interesting. Reminded me a lot of how Pixar works, and they like anthropomorphize something. God, I'm just struggling to say that word.
You're struggling with a lot of words today.
Yeah, sorry.
I think when I become an adult and I have kids, I'm going to establish the bad words as the ones I can't pronounce.
Yeah.
Close them off to these words.
I'm going
to
teach them chemistry, and it's going to be wrong. There are only four elements that comprise the world. Or math, it's going to be like 3 plus chair equals 7.
3 plus chair. I'll always do addition problems using people that are pregnant. If two pregnant women are in a room, how many living beings are in that room?
Like, that's going to get dark.
I don't know, Dad. That's a complex question. Their teacher will be like, 1 plus 1 is always 2.
And they'll just be so confused and angry.
They'll come home. Dad, my teacher's pro-choice.
So criticism of this ad. Is there any?
I can't really find any.
No, not really.
I can't. And that irritates me a little bit.
Right? It's like it's so good that
it is.
It's very Christmassy that you just see it and you're happy because it's Christmas and everything is good. And all was well.
And they didn't overdo it with the Christmas. Like, there's a shot where he's, like, obviously dressed from, like, his Christmas pageant.
Mm-hmm.
He's, like, dressed as one of, like, the wise men.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's, like, another scene where he's just dressed like a wizard, like, trying to make the clock go faster. Like, they didn't overdo the Christmasness of it, which I thought was fantastic. Yeah. The other thing, and this isn't a criticism of the commercial, it's a question, I guess. British people put the presents at the end of their child's bed at night?
I don't know. Maybe.
Because that's how it ends up in Harry Potter all the time.
Harry Potter, I know. That's what I thought too.
And so I always thought it made sense when you're at school because like you're not going to have like family time.
Yeah.
And like if it's in a school setting. But I was like, that would be a really anticlimactic way to get your Christmas presents at the end of your bed to open alone in your room.
Well, it probably saves the parents like another hour of sleep.
Yeah, but you'd think that like, I think most parents who buy gifts
to their kids, they want to watch
like
their
half the joy is like sitting there watching them play with their toys.
Yeah, I have no context for if that's actually a cultural norm for anyone because I haven't experienced that many other families' Christmases. But
yeah,
it obviously plays better in a commercial because the kid can run past them. So
yeah, well yeah, but I'm just to our British listeners.
Yeah, Here's a
question.
Let us know. Is that a thing?
Yeah.
Or if you happen to live somewhere else and you know that that's a cultural norm for somebody.
And also,
let us know.
If that is the cultural norm, do they still say that the gifts are from Santa Claus? And I'm very creeped out if he's coming into every kid's room. There's probably somebody who's sitting listening to this podcast with the same amount of anticipation as that little boy.
It's true.
Well, except instead of waiting for Christmas, he's waiting for us to be done.
Before we go, I'm going to go ahead and actually talk about the musician that we're using this week. We normally just have Music of the Places out, and if you haven't been paying attention or don't really care, we link to that every week on our show notes. But it's always independent musicians who donate their music because, you know, it's really difficult to legally distribute music online, and so we just kind of find musicians that are interested in getting heard and you know somebody we can agree with. And this week we have music from Justin McGuinn. It's from his new album Love Like a Hurricane. It's on iTunes. We're obviously going to link to it in our show notes, and we want to give a big thank you to him and all of the people that have let us, all of the fabulous musicians that have let us play their music at the end of our podcast. And we'd like to say, if you're listening and you've made it this far and you want to send some MP3s our way, or even better, lossless audio files if you've got them, we would love to use your music at the end of our podcast. So
yes, we would.
You can grab contact info from our website or hit us up on Twitter. I'm Will Imholt. That's at Will Imholt.
And I'm Tom Wixo, at Tom Wixo.
And we'd love to hear your music and talk to you next week.
Yeah, sounds good.
Take me away at the speed of light. It's bleeding outside. I can't shield my eyes. I'm wearing thin. I'm cold. No one seems to see me right here inside. You keep me I've nothing left to hide. You took the wrongs and turned them right. I can see it, 'cause you've delivered me from a lie. I believe in the great divide. Say.